Hi, I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine. This month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, highlights from the December 2007 issue. I'm joined once again by Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Hi, Don.
Hi, Chris. Today we'll hear poems by Fiona Sampson and Atsura O'Reilly, and then talk about Clive James' assessment and reassessment of Ezra Pound's cantos. But there's a lot of other stuff in the issue.
A bit of a brutal reassessment, wasn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah, we'll come to that. We've got also a great Italian poetry portfolio. We asked Jeffrey Brock, one of the leading translators of Italian poetry in this country, to give us a taste of the poetry scene in Italy, and we got quite a taste, right, Don?
Yes, we did. It surprised me to see all this poetry that was new to me completely.
One of the poems I loved was by Patrizio Cavalli, and it's translated by Jeffrey Brock. It's about a kind of blithe happiness, and it's an indictment of that kind of blithe happiness. I'll show you just the second half of it. Those stilled by pain don't mix with the cheerful, self-assured runners, but with those who walk at the same slow pace. If one wheel locks and the other's turning, the turning one doesn't stop turning, but goes as far as it can, dragging the other in a poor, skewed race until the cart either comes to a halt or falls apart. I like that. I like the halting movement it makes. I mean, it's bitter, but it's not despairing. You know, it gives a kind of hope to that kind of disabled movement.
Yeah, there's a real liveliness in this poetry. I think people are going to like it. There's sort of a nice counterpoint to it in Alda Marini's aphorisms. She's a poet who lives in Milan. Here's one little piece of her aphorisms. Everyone is a friend of his own pathology. And another one is, I am completely asexual, not counting errors and omissions.
It's interesting that it ends with, no one can know what is between me and God.
Yeah.
All these seem so secular in a way, but then a celebration of the secular, but then this mystical element enters it at the end.
Those aphorisms were translated by Douglas Basford. Another poet I quite liked in this portfolio was Antonella Anetta, and she has a poem in here translated by Sarah Arvio. It's a poem called For My Daughter. I love her fierceness when she fights me, shouting, not fair. Her eyes slitting like shutters in cities by the sea. It's quite something, a very lively poem. It sort of catches fire all the way through. And at the end of all things, she says, we're bound together by peace, no shrieks of pain, and my modesty. We're a canvas by Giovanni Bellini, a virgin and a sweet rabbit. So strange.
Yeah,
just when you
strange.
Think you know the poem, it takes off.
It's a weird shift.
It's good stuff, but of course the ones we're really going to focus on right now are poems by Fiona Sampson and Atsura O'Reilly. Maybe you'd like to say a few things about this Fiona Sampson poem.
Yeah, it's a bit mysterious, I think, if you don't get all of the references. The title is called After the Air Tattoo. The Air Tattoo is the world's largest air show in Gloucestershire. In England, and it begins with all in the stilly night. The quotation is from Thomas More, the man who invented the word utopia. It deals with the muntjac, which is a deer. I did not know this. I had to look it up in Wikipedia. Anything else, Don?
No, that's probably all you need to know, and the rest you can find out on your own.
So here's Fiona Sampson reading After the Air Tattoo.
After the Air Tattoo. All in the stilly night. The muntjac roars from its hedge. A barking roar of July. Heat, its own broken open fruition under black viscous, a sky static with plain roar. The intermission after the greatest air show in the world. Fields and lane recovering. Tarmac tonguing sky again, languid, in the summer half-dark, towards Fairford, where ancient glass trembles, facets of dark open, to tumble out king, revenge tragedy, triumphal colours of God.
There's a beautiful last line, I think, and very unexpected, because it takes you right out of the scene towards, I mean, it's in the scene, there's some kind of play going on, but it takes you back to a revenge tragedy and a king.
Yeah, and when she talks about a revenge tragedy, it sort of folds back on what she says earlier in the poem. It's the greatest air show in the world. It's all kind of a show.
Right.
ancient glass trembles. Facets of dark open to tumble out king, revenge tragedy, triumphal colours of God.
Well, another poem that we're happy to have in the issue is by the mysterious Atsuro Riley.
Yeah, I remember when Atsuro Riley's poems first came across my desk. It was not long after I became editor, and he was an unpublished poet, and they came to me out of the blue. And they were very fastidiously presented. You could tell someone was very conscious of how they were going to appear on the page. But I remember being struck immediately by how strange the voice was, how apparently difficult the poems were at first, but then they aren't really. You read them closely and they open up quite easily.
Yeah, and they sort of remind you of things that are stuck in the back of your mind or things you remember from a long time ago.
Yeah.
Just when you think you're lost and you can't figure out what's going on.
Yeah, fragments of movies, fragments of poems. Hopkins is clearly really important to him.
Yeah, and like Hopkins, he seems to have to invent his own rhythm and even to some extent his own language and music here. Very unexpected, very original stuff. One of the things we can't really tell you about that you have to see when you look at it is that all the lines in this poem, Hutch, are right justified. So right off the bat, you know something's unraveling in a slightly unusual way here.
The poem seems to be about literally it's about a hutch. But what's unnerving about it and disquieting is the way you think about what a hutch is for. It's for a rabbit, maybe it's for a dog, maybe it's for, to store something in. But then he introduces these people who come back from Vietnam, and it seems like they would need some place to hide.
Yeah, or maybe they'd seen people locked up in funny ways in the war.
Let's listen to Atsuro Riley reading Hutch.
The epigraph is by way of what they say. From back when it was Nam time, I tell you what. Them days, men, boys, gone, dark groves rose like Vietnam bamboo. Aftergrowth something awful. Green, have mercy, souls here seen camouflage everlasting. Nary a one of the Brungholms brung home whole. Monk's tar pines come upon this box thing, worked from scrap wood. Puts me much myself in mind of a rabbit crouch. Is it more a meat safe? Set there, hid, bedded there, looking all the world like a coffin. Somebody cares to tend to it like a spring gets tendered, clears the leaves. Whosoever built it set wire window screen down the sides. Long about 5 foot or thereabouts, close kin to a dog crate. A human would have to hunch. Closes over heavy this hingy type lid on it like a casket. Swearing to Jesus, wasn't it eye of pine laid down for the floor? Remembering the Garner twins, Carl and Charlie, come home mute. Cherry bombs, 4th of July, them both belly scuttling under the house. Their crave of pent places, ditch pipes. Monkst tar pines come upon this box thing worked from scrap wood. From back when it was Nam time, I tell you what.
Their crave of pent places, ditch pipes. I love that. I don't know Atsuro Riley personally. I gather that he's from the Deep South.
Well, I tell you what. I grew up in the South, and this poem keeps saying things like, I tell you what.
Exactly.
I hadn't heard that since I was in high school.
Yeah.
But that's what we said all the time. I tell you what. And when I saw that expression in this poem, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, puts me much myself in mind of a rabbit crouch. Yeah.
And there's something about a human would have to hunch, and this poem is full of hunches, sort of strange clues to what it's about. And I guess you feel you never really know what these Garner twins, Carl and Charlie, would say if they could say anything, but the poem tries to help them along a little bit.
Yeah, you don't know what happened to them, and the poem leaves that a mystery, and part of its mystery is being played out in that language, the way those words are rammed together, the way everything is sort of occlusive and mysterious. I love it. I think it's fantastic.
And it's really this kind of writing, I guess, is the only way to connect two worlds, the world of the war over there and what goes on over here where they have cherry bombs on the 4th of July.
Yeah. It's fascinating to think of this in terms of our next writer, Clive James, because this is a poem that couldn't have been written without modernism. And if you think of the father of modernism, it's Ezra Pound. And in this month's issue, we've got one of the great prose writers and poets of our time, Clive James, writing an attack on Ezra Pound.
Well, we all love modernism, bless her soul, and we all try to make our way around Ezra Pound. Bunting called him the Alps. Here we are doing just what Bunting said, trying to find our way around him somehow.
Yeah, it keeps coming up that he won't go away.
He won't go away. And so Clive James says, "When I fell out of love with the Cantos, I fell all the way out." And this piece kind of documents that love story, that first excitement of coming across the Cantos when he was young. And now Clive James takes more than a few steps back. He says, "I think I can nowadays go right through the long text of that doomed project and show that although it has some arresting passages, they are not quite as arresting as their author meant them to be." And then Clive James goes on and says, "I hasten to admit that for my younger self, the claims seemed valid and that I could not have been more arrested if I'd been caught breaking into a liquor store."
Yeah, he's very good at it, weaving together memoir and criticism. And then the piece really is partly a memoir and partly a work of criticism.
Yeah, and it's not just, it is a little brutal in the sense that it's honest, but it's not unthinkingly so.
His early affection is still very
evident. It's still
evident
there, and, yeah. Still there from beginning to end. So he's not just beating up on Pound, which a lot of people do. He says a lot of the good stuff in the Cantos really is worth the sweat of digging it out, even if you conclude that rather less sweat went into dreaming it up than Pound was wont to claim. At the very end of the piece, he really sums the thing up by saying that maybe what the Cantos is or are, or perhaps was or were, is, and this is Clive James' great phrase for it, a nut job blog before the fact.
Yeah, that's terrific, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although it's reductive. I mean, there are, if you think of the way Pound, well, I wonder how Pound exists for you. For me, he does exist in these fragments, but some of the fragments are really, really beautiful. "But the days are not full enough, and the nights are not full enough, and life slips by like a field mouse not shaking the hedge."
It's worth digging around for. "When the mind swings by a grass blade, an ant's forefoot shall save you." But, of course, Clive James gets our number on this one, too, just when we start to love these and worship these lines.
"How's an ant's forefoot going to save you?" Right.
He said, yeah. And he says, "But if the ants hadn't gotten into Pound's pants, he still would have been done in by the bees in his bonnet."
You can find Clive James's article on Ezra Pound in the December 2007 issue of Poetry Magazine and on our website, poetrymagazine.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox with Ed Herman.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Christian Wyman.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.